Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast special. Yes, it's a special today. I'm talking to Drew Povey. You might know him from Educating Manchester, the show on Channel 4, which looks at Harrop Fold School. Very good program. I've met him on Sunday brunch. He was lovely. Then I met up with him for a coffee afterwards a few weeks later because I wanted to discuss education with him because I'm fascinated by it. Fina's here actually today. Hi, Fina.
Hello.
Mark's not with us this morning, Fina's joined us. Fina, I crossed the line today, didn't I, a bit? I got quite passionate and involved.
You did, yeah.
Yeah, so my job, I think, on these podcasts is to ask questions. Today I gave opinions, and I'm not sure how that's going to go down. Actually, I'm not sure. You're an expert on podcasts. You edit quite a lot of podcasts. Should I be giving opinions or just asking questions?
Well, in terms of education, I think it's a very pressing time that you've got to spread your pensées. And especially, you know, you've got kids yourselves. It does affect you.
Yeah. Quite a passionate conversation we have, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's such a lovely guy. And he's as I say, he's so passionate about his school and he's passionate about the education system. I am too. I have my own views on it. It's a very long podcast. Must warn you of that. It goes on for a long time. But is it worth it? Would you say, Fina?
It is, because all of us are affected by education one way or another. We've been through it ourselves, or you've got kids going through it, or you work in education. It involves all of us.
How was your education? Did you enjoy it?
I did. I went to a state school in Guildford, so I had a very positive time. Part of the reason why is because of the inspiring teachers that got me to really enjoy reading books, or they got me to enjoy trying to take part in sports, which I'm not good at.
Well, right. My school education, I went to a state school, and it was my sports teacher, which I talk about with Drew, was the one who kept me at school because I loved him so much. We just used to play so much sport. I absolutely adored it. What did you enjoy doing at school?
So I ended up doing English and philosophy at uni. So I really enjoyed studying just both English literature and also philosophy.
Mm. Okay, let's get on with the podcast. This is Drew Povey.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into Dear Lovejoy.
Drew, welcome to my kitchen. How are you?
I'm not bad, thank you.
First thing I do is I always give guests on my show a present. I've bought this for you. It's The Tools of Titans by Tim Ferriss.
Oh, amazing. Thank you.
It's a book, and I'm laughing because you just went, I tried to get that book, but you want it on audio, don't you? But
definitely read it.
It's too long.
That is a big book.
An audio book. But I love this book because I know you'll love it because I've met you and had a cup of coffee with you, and I know how much how interested you are on people who achieve. And this is a book where it's just, I love it. I still haven't read it all because you can just go through picking bits out and having a little read about them all.
That's so amazing. Thank
enjoy
you.
Enjoy that on your train journey back. So let's explain how you got to where you've got to. We bonded over a coffee and we had a major conversation, didn't we, all about life. And I know you're a very interesting person, but you're from the TV program Educating Manchester. That's where your fame is from now. How did you end up at the school? Tell us the story.
Well, if we wind back about 12 years, about 12 and a half years now, Harrop Fold was deemed to be the worst school in the UK. And that's, as we say to, you know, everyone when we tell this story, that's an educational badge that nobody wants.
No.
And it was due to a failed amalgamation, two schools thrown together. Nobody wanted it to happen. They had the teachers, the students, the parents. Nobody wanted it to happen, but it happened anyway. And it just went into a really bad place. Like 5 head teachers in 5 terms. It was just chaos. And at that time, my older brother Ross was actually training to be a teacher within all that chaos, and he tells some great stories about what happened to him in the classroom during this difficult time at the school. But he was struggling, and he would ring me up literally every Monday night on the phone. Drew, this place is bonkers. You do behavior management, give me some ideas, help me out, because I'm really struggling in the classroom. And I'd kind of talk him through a few ideas of what to do with the kids. And then as time went on, we got to just before Christmas, and my school where I was working at in Warrington had broken up for Christmas, and Ross's was still open, which happened to be Harrow Fold. And he said, why don't you come and see our Christmas show? And I was like, I've got to go and see this place, because I feel like I've been living there, because I've been speaking to him about it.
Can I just ask you what you were doing at the other school?
Yeah, so I was a head of year,
right,
and a head of RE.
Right,
at school, okay, in Warrington, which was an interesting amalgamation of subjects in itself. But came over to the school at Christmas time, and when I was there, the head teacher at the time knew I was coming over, knew I did behaviour management, that was one of my areas of specialism, showed me around the school, and I just thought, I've got to go over, I've got to help out, I've got to do something about this. And the draw of it was incredible, mainly because I looked at these kids and thought, these kids are amazing. They're absolutely brilliant. There are a few difficult kids, but the vast majority were just doing the right things at the right time. And I saw staff working hard as well. And I thought, I need to come and at least, you know, chip in. I need to do something to kind of help this situation move forward.
So tell us about that feeling. Then you felt, you were in the school and you thought, this is the worst school in Britain, but I fancy taking it on.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds ludicrous now just hearing that back, but you go and you see young people who are trying hard and you're thinking, this is wrong. Whatever's happening here is wrong, and I don't know whether I could even make an impact on it. I didn't know whether I'd be able to shift the school particularly, but I knew I needed to go over and help. And you know, when we did have that coffee, I was saying, I think people do the job for three reasons. You do it to get the cash. I think some people just do the job simply to get the money. I think some people do it as a career because they want to, you know, climb the pole and get to the top. And I think other people do their jobs because it's a calling. And I just felt there was a calling for me to go and work at that school, as soft and cheesy as that sounds, that's what it felt like. And I remember going, the first time I went in, there were two queues going into the canteen. There was one enormous queue, and then there was one tiny queue. And the kids in the enormous queue had a yellow ticket, and the kids in the small queue had a red ticket. And I was thinking, well, I wonder what this is all about. And believe it or not, this was only 12 years ago. The ones in the long queue with the yellow ticket were the free school meal kids.
Right.
And it was just the worst example of making kids who are coming from a deprived area stand out more than anybody else and be disadvantaged even further and getting their dinner after everybody else because they came in on a free school meal. And there were things like that as I was walking around the state of the building. And I just thought, I need to come and at least try and do something.
But was there a vacancy, or you just went, no, I want the job?
Well, at the time, which knocks on to our second big issue that we've had as a school, they were just getting anybody that could come and work there. I mean, at that time, they had about 138 members of staff at the school, and 30 of those teachers every day would be supply teachers.
Wow.
How do you run a school? I mean, imagine being a kid there and you're sitting in your class and you're ready to do your English lesson or your maths lesson, and somebody you've never met before comes in front of you, and that could be the third lesson of that day. I mean, what does that say to the kids?
Yeah, do you know what? I've been through the school system, and I'll talk more about this as we go along, but one of my real frustrating things when I moved my kids from a school once was because the turnover of staff was so huge. I thought none of them are investing time in the children. And that is the problem, isn't it? If you know you're only going to be there for a day, or you're a supply teacher going to be there for a small period of time, why invest your time and energy into these children?
Yeah, you wouldn't. I mean, there are some great supply teachers, yeah, but there's also a heck of a lot of them, and there's, which, you know, would explain there's a very good reason why they've not got a job.
Yeah.
Because they can't cut it, or they don't want to cut it, or they don't want to invest that time, as you rightly point out. So it was a nightmare, and I felt I needed to come across. So there wasn't a job, but the head teacher at the time said, look, we want to do something different with behavior. You know, you're young, we've heard you do different things with behavior. Would you be interested in coming over? And at first I really wanted to go, but I love my job over at a school in Warrington, and they've been really good to me. And I thought, I need to think about this. I went back, and after a couple of days, I thought, no, I need to go and do something. It's kind of that pull that it had for me. So I got in touch with the school and I said, look, let's explore that and let's see where it goes. So I ended up joining the school later on that year, probably around just before Easter time, I think it was. And it was just great from the moment I started. I absolutely loved it, and the kids were great. And I think because they'd been through a difficult time, anybody standing in front of the kids and saying to them, we can do something, we're going to turn this school around, you're going to be a major part of that, that is, was quite exciting for the kids. And very quickly they got on board, because, you know, why would they listen to people who weren't going to hang around and stick by them and stay there?
I had Reverend Richard Coles on this podcast the other day, and we talked about feeling part of something, feeling part of a community that is important. I assume that's what these children were started to feeling when you came along. They felt like they were part of something.
Yeah, I mean, we've written a book that really does journal a lot of this. Also to raise more money against the debt, which is the main driver behind it. But there's a story in the book where the first week I was at the school, they were breaking, you know, the glass that you have, the fire glass in windows, the old fire glass had the bits of wire between. Yeah. And they were breaking those, or three of those a day, and each one was about £350 to replace, to get somebody out to replace it with specialist glass. So I was working out, it's over £1,000 a day. So I did this tour around the school where I went into every classroom and I said to the kids, look, you're breaking this fire glass every day. It's costing £350 a pop, £1,000 a day. I reckon over 2 weeks we could do a lot more with that £10,000 if we didn't break the windows. And you could see the kids looking at me thinking, is this guy for real? And let's see where he's going with it. So I said, if you've got any ideas of what you think the money should be spent on, that money should be going on you anyway, because that's what the money does that's coming into schools. Why don't you come and have a chat with me? A group of lads were into rap music. It was 2005, 2006. So they came over and they're like, we'd like a basketball court, sir. And they had this awful, like, you know, really poor tarmacked area. So I said to the business manager, if we do save this money, can we do this basketball court? And they were like, yeah, okay, not that. If they can stop and break in the glass, we'll literally do anything. So we went 9 days. I'd love to say we went the full 2 weeks without any broken glass. We went 9 days without any of those windows being broken, because obviously they were going to say, okay, let's see what this guy's made of. Let's test it. Let's go with him. And on the 10th day, we did have a window broken in the afternoon. But I said to the business manager, look, we've done it. Let's build him a basketball court. So within a week of that happening, we built this basketball court.
Wow.
And the difference that made to the kids was just enormous, because that's us saying to the kids, you're worth it. Forget those 30 supply teachers that are coming in. We want to invest in you. This is your school. If we pull together, we can do something great. And they really got behind it. And we did something with some of the tricky year 11 lads, which was interesting as well.
What?
Well, we, on the first day, I think the kids thought, well, they were like, who's this lunatic who's working at our school? Because I went into the upper site and I just said to them, okay, where are all the hard lads? And they were like, this.
Did you go with his shirt off? Come on then.
not quite with my wife Peter on. I just said, okay, where are the hard lads? And they were, all the kids were going, oh, you want to go to that corner over the playground over there, Mr. Povey? So I went over there, they didn't know me, and they were like, who are you? And I'm like, I'm Mr. Povey, and I want to speak to the hard lads. So they were like, well, we're hard, and there's someone's over there as well. It was funny, the dynamic of who was hard as well. You know, you can imagine it, can't you? Yeah. Archetypal shaved heads. So I got a group of them together and I said, right, I want to see you boys at 10 o'clock, which was break time, in the gym tomorrow, and bring all the hard lads with you. And they were like, why? And I said, well, you'll turn up at the gym tomorrow and you'll find out. And with that, just walked off. So probably about 5 to 10 the next day, I was in the gym. It's this awful gym, kind of ripped up flooring, like this horrible green, like it was almost like velvet flooring. It was an awful thing. It was in a right state. And I'm standing in the gym in my hands in my pockets thinking, I wonder if any of these lads will turn up. Anyway, bang on 10, the bell goes. A couple of minutes later, this right bunch of lads turn up, you know, jewelry all over, necklaces out. It was like literally something from a film. And they've come in, must have been expecting me to have a fight with them or hit them or something. And they've like kind of like not spoken, but kind of nodded their head as if, what do you want? And I've said, right, we're going to have a rugby team. And we're going to be the most feared rugby team in across the north. We're going to be fair. We're going to be brutal, but we're going to be disciplined and we're going to be extremely fair. But I want every single school to know about us and be scared of us. And if you're tough and you think you're tough, you can play rugby, then we'll do it. And it was interesting because I was fortunate with this, because this can go one of a couple of ways, as you can imagine. one of the lads there was a rugby player and had signed for Salford Reds. So he was straight away going, that's brilliant, I'm up for it. And then a few of the other lads, yeah, well, I'll turn up then. And then the next night we had a rugby practice because I played a little bit, you know, a decent level growing up. I was obviously much quicker and they were 15-year-old lads. I'm, you know, was in my mid to late 20s. So I played with them. They realised I could play a bit. And from that moment on, that group of boys just totally got me and knew what I was doing. And the reason I did that was, A, to get those boys on board, but also with any other kid in the school, if they're going to say to me, well, you know, or they're going to try it on, or, well, we're not going to listen to Mr. Povey, or we're not going to do as we're told, I'd always say something like, oh, well, Jake, year 11, do you know Jake? Oh, yeah, yeah, I know Jake. Well, he has ultimate respect for me and wouldn't dare use bad language anywhere near me, so I don't see why you're doing it. And the kids straight away then will go home at night, speak to Jake on the estate. Jake could say, he's sound, Mr. Povey, behave for him. And from that point on, kind of, you know, all the behaviour management throughout the whole school, the kids got me and it was good.
That's fantastic. How are they breaking the windows? What were they doing?
Just elbowing them. Just literally help, walking past them and help you elbow those things hard. They crack one side. It's, you know, it's a health and safety issue. You have to replace the glass. It's simple. So that's what they were doing with it.
Do you know what's interesting? You said, again, you're getting people to engage, aren't you? And you're getting people to feel part of something. It reminds me of my friend who's from Norway who said to me once, the problem with your tax system in Britain or your society in Britain, he loves coming over here, by the way, he says you pay all your taxes and you never see anything back for it. And that is the problem. You always think it's just going into a bottomless pit. So everyone in Britain resents their money. Whereas in Scandinavia, I'm out of my depth here, by the way, because I don't know Scandinavian politics, but I go there, it all looks shiny and new to me. They say, we put our money in and we see new stuff all the time. And I've always thought that's a really interesting thought process, that if one of the governments started just building stuff or showing that you were getting something back for your money, people wouldn't mind maybe putting so much money in the,
well, linking, you know, to tax, it even that's a great idea actually, even at linking it and saying, you know, if you're paying this amount of money, you will have saved, you know, so many people on the NHS, you'll have allowed so many people to be educated by teachers this year. If we got some correlation with what the money was spent on, that might mean something.
But everything always takes so long as well, and it has to go through so many committees. The idea that you built a basketball court within 10 days saying, oh, you're going to do it, and then within 10 days they see you're actually going to do it, must have been really impressive for them, because they must have lived in places where nothing happens for them ever in their society. Yeah. And suddenly a man's come along and go, hey, I could do some stuff for you.
Yeah.
And it's not just about learning. It's about fun. Basketball's fun.
Of course it is. And the area of Little Halton has been really overlooked as an area. So it wasn't just our school. I mean, I think this was bubbling under the surface way before the amalgamation. Little Halton is an area in Salford. Used to be Bolton. Right on the outskirts of Salford. It's been significantly underdeveloped. So I think there was a much bigger issue than just an amalgamation of two schools going on.
So anyone who watches Educating Manchester will know that you got the three of you, two brothers, you got your two. Well, one of your brothers already there.
Yeah.
Then you came and then you've got your other brother in.
Yes, the younger one.
So all three of you there running the school. And it's been a success, hasn't it? Immense success.
Yeah, I mean, it's having the three brother dynamics really good anyway. I think it's good for our kids to see that kind of sibling rivalry at times as well, because we'll have a laugh and a joke on the corridor. One kid, when we came in one day, the three of us on the corridor, because obviously it's great, isn't it, for a kid, if he's three Poveys on the corridor and one of them shouts, Mr. Povey, we're all going to turn around at once. So that's like, that's the favourite thing they do. But another one of them came up to us and went, were your parents stupid, sir? I was like, well, what do you mean, my parents stupid? He said, well, they've called you all the same name. And I was looking and going, let me guess, your parent, you and your family have all got different surnames. And he was like, yeah. And I was like, okay, well, let me explain how it worked in our family. So I had to explain that to him. But no, kids are great. And having the three brothers there is good for a number of reasons. And it was important to bring Ben over, because Ben had a different skill set than Ross and I had as well, because of his background. Well, he worked in residential care homes. So when you work in a residential care home and these people are doing amazing, amazing things and we don't know anything about it. So if there's a child that literally can't access the system at all, they'll kind of be educated and they'll be living in this home with these care workers who are on very little money, who are literally dealing with the most difficult and challenging scenarios possible. So he'd been in that work stream, and he'd been working with kids with attachment disorder. So when Ben came over to school, he had a couple of mindsets that aren't that popular probably in education. One of them is with regards to therapeutic care, which is we've got to find a solution to help this person get through this issue, which sometimes in education we wash our hands of kids, and I think we've got a major issue with that. The other thing that Ben came with was this idea in his head that there is no cutoff point. You know, schools will go so far with a young person, but then after a while they're going to say enough's enough, there's a cutoff point. But obviously when you work in a care home, there is no cutoff point. I mean, Ben's been bitten, he's been wrestled, he's had wardrobes thrown down the stairs at him, he's experienced it all, but then they have to keep going with them. So that coming into education was really interesting, that therapeutic angle on these are our kids, they've got to be our kids and they'll stay our kids, was very refreshing for us to come in. And that's the reason why we've not excluded a kid, or one of the reasons why we've not excluded a student from our school fixed term or permanently for over 10 years.
How many were being excluded prior to you joining?
I think the numbers, I'd have to check in the book, but I think it's about 460 a year.
Wow.
So that's fixed term and permanent.
I'm laughing, but that's terrific, isn't it? That they're being they're basically rejected.
That's it. Yeah, you're just saying to a kid, you can't be here for an amount of days, and we can't deal with you. And of course, what happens when a kid goes home? Well, what they're going to sit on their Xbox if you're lucky, or they're going to get up to worse things than that. And then you expect them to come back in and be different and better behaved. I mean, that's just not happening, is it?
How old were you when you took this job on?
27.
That's young.
Yeah.
Really young, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't go as head. I went as head of behaviour to sort it out. So I had this strange role as a senior teacher and just went over and just went head first into behaviour. I was working in elite sport as well.
So what age did you become the head teacher?
31.
What elite sport were you doing?
So I work in rugby league.
Right.
But I've done some work in rugby union as well. And, I think what I learned about leadership in sport was transferable to education, and what I've learned in education is transferable to sport. And then over the last 9 years since I've been ahead, I'm very much interested in an idea of multi-sector perspectives of leadership, which for me, we're all doing the same thing. So whether you're leading a TV series that we'll watch, or a chief constable's leaving the police, or an exec leader's leading the NHS, or a head teacher, or a corporate leader. We do a lot of work in corporate now. We're all trying to pretty much do the same thing. And therefore, those skills of leadership need to be shared across, and that's how we've got into the leadership world.
All right, I'm slightly confused about your what you were before you were the head of this school then. So you were a teacher?
A senior leader in the school.
But before you joined the school?
Yeah.
What do you do, Drew?
Okay. So I've always worked in sport one day a week, but at the weekend.
I see. So that's a part-time job.
Part-time hobby thing. Part-time job. And then, so I started off coaching. I've done works in supplements and nutrition, but then I really got into the leadership work.
Okay.
And I could see that at the weekends and in holiday times, we got holidays, I'd always work in sport at those times. And that was really good for me and my learning, as well as doing a lot of reading, as you know.
Yeah.
Every day I've been wanting to learn more about leadership, and those things have been essential for the work we've been doing at Harrow.
We'll speak more about that. That's why I bought you that book, Tools of Titans, because you talk a lot about leadership. So and there's a lot of leaders quoted in there. We'll come back to that, but let's carry on with this story, because when you came to our attention was when Educating Manchester happened. So obviously the TV company approached you. Tough decision to put your school under the microscope like that?
Yeah, it was huge. And that wasn't my decision to make alone. And we talked about that sense of, after the broken windows, we created a team. Those kids are part of the team. So it was their vote and choice as well. And it was exactly the same for the staff that work at the school. So there was no way I could make that decision in isolation. That had to be done with the team at Harrop, and we call it Team Harrop, and we had to make that call together. My job was to bring the information to the staff and the kids, but without prejudice. So I didn't tell anybody whether I thought it was a good idea or not. I just said, here's the information, brought people in to speak to them, people who'd done it before, got information about the TV series, did as much due diligence as we could, but then handed that over to the kids and staff and said, here's the information, go away, think about it, come back, and we did a vote.
Oh, how did the vote go?
Over 90% in favour.
Wow.
And the 8% that weren't that didn't say yes were not a no, they were an unsure. They just weren't sure. So we didn't have anybody collectively across the school that thought it was a bad idea. But I probably need to fill in the middle section of the story, because we went from worst school in the country. We came through that. Mm-hmm. But then we moved into a new building in 2008. Life was good. 2009, after the global financial crash had really started to hit, we got saddled with this deficit. And I'd just become head teacher at the time. And we were like, well, how much is it? And we were told it was £3 million. Which was a major problem. I mean, how the hell does a school find 3 million? It was a disgrace, because this money was spent by the local authority and central government, and for it to be put on a school was just terrible. But that wasn't actually the worst of it. The £3 million was one thing, but obviously we'd dropped school numbers. I mean, who wants to go to the worst school in the country? So we went from 1,200 kids to 600 kids. So we've lost half of our income, because we'd lost half of our intake, and our projections were going to go to 6.7 million in debt over a 5-year period. So when I first took over from my predecessor and was running the school, everybody was saying to us, it won't work. On paper, this is not, you're not going to be able to draw a level for 2.5 years, never mind pay back 3 million. How does a school, particularly in a PFI setting, how does a school make money? How does it pay back money? Particularly when you're dealing with the top 1% of deprivation, which is the area we serve in the Amblecote estate. So it was a shocker, really.
Why is a bloody school having to pay back money?
Oh, he's mad. I understand why the money was spent, because a lot of money was spent to get it out of special measures. But of course, in 2004, 5 and 6, we could all buy houses for whatever we wanted, mortgages, loans. I mean, money was money, wasn't it? And a lot of money was spent.
Right.
By the government on pretty much anything that they want to spend the money on, and particularly in education, we could spend whatever. Eventually that's come back, and I know the local authority in Salford, they haven't got any money, and central government haven't got any money, but for us then to have to wrestle with it just isn't right.
Got money for certain things though, haven't we? I won't get too political, because but we do manage to spend money when we want to spend money, don't we, on various different things.
Yeah, I agree.
I think spending money on our children's probably the most important thing or up there. So you say that's the middle bit of the picture. So what has that got to do with the TV show?
Well, there? Obviously, when they came, well, it's not obvious, is it? When they came to ask us if we want to do the TV show, we had to think long and hard about what we could gain from doing the TV show and also what we could lose. Because when we realised that debt was so big, and then we were told it's the worst debt of any school in the country, you're kind of going, how can one school be the worst school in the country 12 years ago, then kind of 5 years later have the worst debt of any school in the country? Can we really afford to go out and do a national TV show and potentially get any more hits to our reputation? Because our reputational capital would have been pretty damn low at the time.
Yeah.
So that was something we were extremely careful about thinking through. And I suppose there's two ways of looking at it, isn't it? You can kind of say to yourself, well, can't really get any worse, can it? Really, it can't get any worse. Or you start to look at it and say, well, you know, so it can't get any worse, we've got a lot to gain, or, you know, we're on the way up here, why jeopardize that? You know, what you've taken 6 or 7 years to build up, we're a good school, we're going in the right directions, results aren't there yet, but they will be over the next couple of years. Why jeopardize that and potentially take another fall if the TV show doesn't come across in the right way? So it was hard.
Are they paying you for the TV show, though?
A little. But when I say a little, it was literally covering expenses, because I don't think they make a lot of money out of those types of documentaries.
It's not a lot of money in TV now. It's. I mean, there is still huge amounts, obviously, but it's not like it used to be. So many channels, it's all been watered down a bit. So what do you set to gain from doing it then?
A couple of things. We've been asked, okay, so why on earth would you put yourselves through this after you've had this kind of history? And I said, a couple of things. Number one, I am so passionate that this school gets the credit it deserves. because this isn't me. I mean, if people, you know, sometimes with when a leader's had something to do with something, they think it's the leader who's been this, you know, amazing person that's come in on a, as a knight on a horse and sorted everything out. It wasn't, you know, this is down to a hell of a lot of work from young people who've decided to get hold of their school and their education. Some quite incredible staff who've come to the school and decided to, you know, throw their lives and their livelihoods into it when it's not the easiest job. You know, they could earn more money and have a lot less hassle somewhere else.
Yeah, but you're giving them the ability to do that.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a good place to work. But
you're giving the kids and the teacher the ability to fail and succeed, and most importantly, succeed.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that creates a buzz within the workplace. So it's a decent place to work. But I wanted to shine a spotlight on that. I think everybody that's been part of Team Harrop, from the governors at the top of the school who have let me do some pretty crazy things over the years, from the students to the staff and to the local community, this was payback time, but for the right reasons. So we wanted to shine a light on it and say, you know, the people realize what's happening here. We are different. We've had to run the school differently. The relationships we think are different to other schools. So therefore, put ourselves out there on the map and celebrate the success. The other side to this, though, that I'm particularly passionate about is that there's so much negativity about education. And we know so many people are leaving education. I was very passionate that our school could be a real voice for good for education too, to say, this is the best job, literally the best job in the world. I've said this many times before, but I'll say it again. If I won the lottery, I'd do a couple of things. Number one, I'd pay our debt off, of course. And number two, I'd go straight back to work and carry on doing exactly what I'm doing now. It is an incredible job. And by showing the amazing things that teachers do, and the great things that kids do, the frustrating things they do, but the heartwarming things they do, and the connect with parents, I think I almost felt like we had a duty in some strange way to put something out there for education that says this is a great job.
And I think what you've done is really important. And though I need to be honest with you, I think I've told you this before, that when I knew you guys were coming on the show on Sunday brunch, do you enjoy coming on the show, by the way?
It was amazing.
Oh, good.
Great show. I'd have to say that, but I actually really mean it. It was a brilliant show. Out of all the things we did, there was a unique culture, I'd say, actually, that I felt more like Harrop's culture within the show than we experienced anywhere else. Not that the others were bad, but yours was sparking, very different.
We try and make it really good fun behind the cameras as well as when we're on set, and we try and make it like it's a laugh.
Oh, it's brilliant. I mean, we didn't want to go. We were like clinging on. Right at the end of it, you were like, come on, lads, it's time to go now. The cleaners are in.
Anyway, who was on the show with you, by the way? Did you have any exciting celebrities?
Yeah, we had Jason Manford.
Oh, he's funny, isn't he?
He's brilliant. And his cousins go to our school.
Oh, brilliant.
So that's even better.
Yeah.
Who else did you have on? Nadine from, she's a singer. I probably should know, my wife knows who it is. I want to say Girls Aloud.
All right, okay, yeah.
I don't know.
All right.
Nadine Coyle. Yeah, Nadine, sorry. And there was a guy written a book.
Okay. So when you came on, I was a lot of conversations with my exec producer over it, because I worry about using children for entertainment. So I kept saying to her, what, and then she was going, oh, they'd have done all their due diligence and everything else. And I'm going, yeah, but I don't trust TV. I trust, bizarrely, the school more than I trust TV industry, because I know how the TV industry works.
Yeah,
they need
ratings.
That's how they need things. And I was sort of very unsure about the whole thing. I walked into the green room and met you and your brothers, and I went, this lot are brilliant. And I realized genuinely, because you're passionate and I could tell you cared. And that's the thing. You care, but how did you square it off, the fact that children were going to be put on TV?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of responses to this. The first thing I've got to say is kids are so savvy about this. When we were talking to them about it, they were like, I'm not bothered about being on TV. That'll be gone. I've got my YouTube channel. I've got all these followers on here. I've got 1,000 hits on this. What are you on about, sir?
Yeah.
And they were very, very matter of fact about it. Like, look, there's that much content out there. I just think it's a different mindset. If it would have been years ago and people would have been recording it on a VHS, you know, or a Betamax recorder, and they'd had it for life, I think there's more of a danger. I honestly think it's a bigger problem for people of our age bracket than it is for the kids. They were totally like not got a problem with it. And it wasn't them being naive. They just live in a different world to us. There was another young girl in year 9, and I was on the corridor. We have lots of visitors come in, whether it might be in Hopkins, Chief Constable of Greater Manchester Police, or if you were ever in the area, we'd invite you in and you could walk round, and then I'd show this, you know, tell the kids you were coming in and we'd walk round. And at the end of it, you give me some comments about the kids. And then I'd go back the next day and say, this is what Tim Lovejoy said about you. And it's great for the kids that it builds them up. And it might be a sports person, it might be a sports coach, it might be a dignitary from Salford or Manchester. It doesn't really matter. Somebody that they'll have heard of or know of or has an elevated position. That's great for our kids in terms of building their esteem. So I try and get at least one of those in a week if I can, or one every couple of weeks. And there was a year nine girl, and she pulls me to one side and said, sir, you know, you're always bringing these visitors in. And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, and you want to show the school off, and you want us to be proud of Team Harrop, and you want us to all pull together. I'm like, yeah, I do know, because I do it every week. What's your point? And she went, well, we've got an opportunity to do a TV show, and we've got an opportunity to show everybody how good we are. So why aren't we doing it? And in fairness to her, she had me banged to rights. And at the end of that, I said, that's a really good point. I shared that with the staff and with the students as well. I didn't say which students had said it, but the kids wanted to show the school off. And I think young people want to be proud of what they're doing.
They do. TV being TV, it sort of wants to feature the bad stuff as well as the good stuff. So there were subjects covered like poverty and bullying.
Yeah.
How does that work as a teacher? Or as the head of the school, you're watching these kids go through that. Are you okay with that? Are you conscious of these kids are going to be seen as being bullied or as a bully?
Yeah, we did a lot of work on that in terms of looking at the edits alongside the students and their families, and we taught them through it. We didn't want to do a soft round the edges Disney style, everything comes good at the end, let's just deal with a small little issue and watch it go through. We wanted to say, this is what happens in schools, this is what young people are going through, and the young people were passionate about that too. So it wasn't just about bullying and things like that. You know, we had self-harm in there. I mean, that is a major issue in schools at the moment. We had serious mental health issues linked to the self-harm. We had teenage pregnancies. We did have silly behavior in the small stuff and kids overcoming small adversity, but we had some big stuff in there as well. And that was an important part of it for us as a school. We said, if we're going to do this, we need to show exactly what is happening in our schools and what young people are going through. Because I don't know about you, but I don't read much stuff about how good young people are at the moment. I hear about the hoodie culture. I hear about them smoking drugs. I hear about them smoking in general or drinking. And these are the absolute minority of kids. And that is not me saying this as a head teacher, because I'm completely biased towards young people because I work with them every day. This is what the stats are saying. So I was at, I was speaking to lung cancer nurses, and we did through the leadership work a few weeks ago. And there's a guy on before me, and he was saying that young people aren't smoking. You know, something like 16% of people are still smoking across the UK, but less than 6% of those are below the age of 16. So young people aren't doing all this bad stuff, actually, that people are talking about. And they're overcoming some difficult things. So if you take Cody as an example, she was really difficult at school, you know, and you can see that through the TV show. And she had difficulties. She lost her mum. She's self-harming. She had all those difficulties. But that kid's come good in the end, and she should be proud of herself. She's gone to college. She's studying to be a teaching assistant. She came back to us about a month, 6 weeks ago, and said, could I do a placement in school? And we're like, absolutely, let's get you back in. She'll be such an asset to our school, and we're going to start an apprenticeship with her so she can go right the way through the system and come back and give back in school, and has a whole range of life experiences that are going to be beneficial to her. Now, that for Cody was significant, and she's now, if you speak to her, actually really proud that she put her story out there on TV for any other young lady that might be going through that and having to wrestle with those things. She's saying, no, I'm proud I've done it, Mr. Poe, because we've kept in contact with all of them, even the ones that have left, and her story's incredibly inspiring for a young person that might be in their room at home, struggling, nobody to talk to, but they might have been able to connect with what Cody's gone through. I also think it's good for people outside of education to realise, including people in government, to realise we're not just there to get kids' exam grades, even though they are crucial.
Will Storr was on this podcast. He wrote a book called Selfie. I recommend you read this book, Drew. You'll love it. And he explains in it about why children. You actually, you get it, and it's called Selfie, and you think it's all going to be about, you know, how people are self-obsessed with each other taking pictures. The first chapter is about suicide and depression, how it's just on the rise, and how it's, I mean, it's horrific for our kids. And they talk about young people, and with social media and various different other elements, I won't go into it all now, there's more ways to fail than there ever has been. And yeah, even if you're, he sat there with me and he went, you're on TV, you've got a successful show, and you know, you're doing this podcast, you've been working in TV for years, do you think you're a success or a failure? And it's kind of true that I don't think I'm a total success, but you know, and I've done all this. Think about people who aren't doing that, and it's like social media continually, every time you go on there, someone's better than you, and you're failing. There's a lot of different things with the muscle dysmorphia amongst young men, and anorexia and eating disorders amongst young girls as well. All these sort of things are coming, and that at school you must be witnessing this all the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. Does he touch on the idea in the book? Because I'm really fascinated about this. I was talking about this with somebody recently. You know, that idea that when you're putting something on social media, you've got to make out everything's great, haven't you? Like, yes. You're all, everything's amazing, I look great, and this is fantastic, and we do, the filtering, is it? I mean, it's no good for me, it doesn't matter how many filters go on. You know,
you're a good looking guy, Drew.
You can't polish this turd, as they say. but there's something in my head about this, that if you're constantly making out everything's great, that in itself is really difficult, because that in itself is exhausting. You know, walking around pretending everything's great all the time, we understand enough about the mind to go, you can't, you know, keep faking it like that, otherwise it's going to catch up with you. So I think the whole idea, I mean, this book sounds fascinating.
Yeah, Will Storr's book's not about social media, it's about how we got here. It starts with the ancient Greeks and how we become obsessed with ourselves.
Right.
And it's a lovely journey through it all, and how we've arrived at where we've arrived. However, we have arrived at where we've arrived, and you touched upon a point just a minute ago. I'm frustrated with our school system. You know this, because I've told you this.
I do know this.
I've got two children who are 15. Anyone who's connected with my children and school, can they switch off now, please? Because I've got two children who are 15, and they're going through their GCSEs. And I've got one girl who's a daughter who's 4 and a half, who's entered school. into her school. She skips into school, she loves it, she makes rockets, she plays, she reads, she's doing all those exciting things. The 15-year-olds are stressed because they've got GCSEs, they've got to get their exams. There is no teaching, it seems, of there's no teaching of mindfulness, happiness, love, jealousy, actual emotions. We talk about schools having to educate children to get them into life. It seems to be just exams and not about the whole holistic thing of everything encompassing life. Is that not a problem, do you think?
It's a huge problem. Am I a fan of this education system? No, I'm not. And I've said that on a number of different platforms. I think we've got to look at the system again and say, what is it to do? You pick on a really important point there, Tim, that we're supposed to be preparing kids for life, and what is the current system doing? It is giving them some rigor in terms of, you know, academic achievement, and getting exam certificates and exam grades is a part of an important part of life. But a guy I know refers to this as it's a ticket, isn't it? It can kind of get you into certain places, it can get you into certain realms that you might want to go into.
Where you employ people, Drew, sorry to interrupt you, but where you employ people, you probably have to go show us your CV and then their education, because you're employing people.
Yeah.
Where I employ people, which is in the entertainment industry, I've never asked for a CV in my life. I kind of get a CV, but I don't ask for their education, because it's an ideas-based industry. So I judge them by their personalities.
Yeah, and that, I mean, but we do the same, but we're different probably to most places. We would judge on character. So we recruit on character. That's the first thing we look at before we look at competence in any way. But we do live in a world in many ways that does value academic rigor. And I understand that. My concern with the system is that that's not right for everybody. And we've now got a one size fits all system that we're forcing every single kid through. And we are narrowing the curriculum down to I mean, I've been in education for the best part of 20 years, and it's narrower than when even I went to school. So this is over 30 years. This is like a 1950s education model where kids are being forced into subjects they don't want to do, they don't like doing, because that's what's expected of them.
Yeah, what is the history of it? Because wasn't it so that they could tell whether clerks were any good working in banks and things like that? So that's why they were judging them on their maths and English, and we've never moved on from that system. Is that kind of how it is, or
yeah,
not really?
Well, I think there are merits to all the subjects. I mean, I like a rounded education. The problem is now it's narrowing. And what we've done with the exam system is we've made it an exam system as opposed to a coursework system. So that, again, excludes so many different kids. So what we're doing here, as you narrow a curriculum down and you go, it's just going to be 8 subjects. A lot of schools will just teach 8 subjects and no more, which, you know, for, you know, an area that you work in, that's no use to you. And the arts are definitely being narrowed down. Things like PE are being narrowed down. I mean, how on earth can you have RE, a subject I teach or used to teach, not as one of the EBAC subjects? So for example, yeah, you can have history and geography, they count, but RE doesn't count. That goes in a different area. And you're thinking to yourself, how does that, in a world that we live now, you know, this diverse world we live in, how can RE not be as important as history and geography? But it's not. And what they've done is they've put value on subjects. And I think that's a very dangerous thing to do, because we don't live in a world that just values certain elements of work. And when you narrow a curriculum, and when you therefore push kids into that system, you're going to get more kids saying, I don't want to be part of this, I don't want to be going to school. And then when it's not any coursework where you can start to work on it over time, it's just on an exam, that increases stress levels. We've got a serious problem. And I think the more we carry on down this track, the more we're going to see mental health issues rise. And it's not just because of the exam system. We go back to the social media issue. I was asked this recently, you allow mobile phones in the schools? I went, yes, we do. And again, I say, look, we're preparing kids for life. Like, are you going to use a mobile phone in your life? Of course you are, not just in your life, but you're going to use it for work. So we need to teach kids how to use it responsibly rather than burying our heads in the sand and not do it. Now, I've copped quite a bit of flack for that. And somebody said to me, yeah, but what about social media? That's you know, encouraging kids, the rise of mental health with kids. And I'm like, but who the hell's going to teach these kids how to use it? Because I'm a parent and I don't understand half of it. So I can't do it as a parent. I'm not going to be able to teach them how to do that. If we don't do it in schools, who is actually going to teach kids the responsible way of handling social media? And we can only do that in schools if the kids have got the phones. I mean, we can do a dry session with them without the phones out, but if it's not based in some kind of reality. So I think there's a number of things that are causing kids to have some significant stress in work. And the only thing that's really valued in school, now everyone's going to tell you this isn't true, but it is true. And you ask any head teacher, they'll tell you it's true. The only real thing that's valued in schools are your exam results.
Yeah, see, this is what I think as adults, we've got to have a long, hard look at ourselves. I think we've got ourselves in a horrific system. Every time I talk to other parents about this, none of them agree with me. I think we've all been absolutely brainwashed into this ridiculous GCSE A level. I've my kids are involved in it, and I've seen it firsthand that they're sucking the life out of them. They're obsessed with these ridiculous exams. Their homework has become so intense. They're stressed. Why do we think it's a good idea as adults to send our children to somewhere that stresses them out? I look at my children, I'm honest with my children. They go, because everyone says school's the best years of your life. No, it's not. I've had so much fun since I left school, even working in clothes shops and mortgage places. I've had fun. At school, it was a bit stressy, even though I loved it because of the football. But you know, and the sport. But I said, when you leave, it's all right. The pressure's off. Why are we putting that pressure on our children? I don't get it. So I went to a parents' evening. Sorry about this long ramble, but this is an important subject to me because I think things need to change. I went to a parents' evening the other day, and one of the teachers said, so when it comes to the exam, my children are doing well, by the way, but when it comes to the exam, they got 45 minutes to answer the 3 questions. And I went, why? So what do you mean why? I said, why is it sorry, 1 hour, 45 minutes. Why is it 1 hour, 45 minutes? That seems like a really stressful amount of time to put a child through to answer 3 questions. What is that proving to the exam board? What does it mean? She goes, well, that's how they judge them. And I said, but that seems ridiculous because children work at different rates. How are you judging whether a child's good through an hour and 45 minutes? She didn't like the question. My daughter didn't like it, kept nudging me going, shut up, Dad. But I was like, I don't get it. What does that actually mean? Which one of these kids has got the best memory? And then the next teacher I went on to, I was talking about how they've moved the system from A, B and C's, A stars and all that sort of stuff, to 9, 8, 7, 6. I said, how does that help the children and the schools? How is that helping? And she had no idea. And I said, do you think it's a good idea? And she said, well, I'm not here to make an opinion. I went, you're the teacher. If you're not going to make the, who is? Why are you not investing in this? Because I don't think it's a good idea, because I think they've got even more ways to fail now, because they've got a bigger spread of marks, in my opinion. I don't really know, because I'd like to understand your point of view. But to me, you're just setting the children up all the time to be under this immense stress, and I just don't understand it.
Yeah. I mean, the whole idea of anything in life, I can't think of anything in life where you're judged like every 16 years, like through an exam for an hour and 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's pass or fail, because that's basically what it is. We're going to get kids ready for 16 years, right? When we're teaching them to read and write, we're going to, and that doesn't happen in work. So it's not prepared. It's crazy. It doesn't make any sense. And there was a problem with coursework, because people were breaking the rules with coursework. But I feel like the baby has well and truly been thrown out with the bathwater, because all we needed to do was actually reform the way coursework was done. And therefore we could have had coursework alongside exams, because you're right. What we actually want, and you ask anybody that employs people, we want people who can work hard over time. We don't want somebody who can come in and blag it or ace it or just work hard for one thing and then not bother after that. We're potentially rewarding the wrong things. And it's only good for top-end kids, this system. So they put in the number system. So you've got more. So like a 7 is equivalent to like an A star. And then you've got like an A. And then you've got an A star, which is an 8. And then a 9 is like an A star star. Which is, you know, for the very bright kids, that's amazing, because we can distinguish the brightest kids. But what about the kids down at the lower end who won't even get a 1, because the exams are harder than they were previously?
Looking across in Europe, Finland's supposed to have the greatest education system in the world. I was looking through some of it today. They start later. They don't really like homework.
Yeah.
They refuse to stream children. So they put the clever kids with the kids who aren't as good.
Yeah.
And it seems to be working for them. Why can't we do a system like that?
Yeah, well, you know, we could. But it's a big ship to turn around. But we need to do it. We need to do it quickly, because the reform's got to happen at some point. Because if we carry on like this, we're going to be only valuing a few kids that are coming into our school. And, you know, when you talk about teams there, that is crucial. You know, you don't want a team full of goalkeepers or a team full of strikers. The team wouldn't function there. You've got to have people who can play all the various positions. But in our education system, we seem to value a certain type of young person. And I think that is really dangerous. And it's not, of course, going to help us in society. We've got to do something about it pretty quick. And I think if you look at countries like Finland, we are different to Finland. So I get a bit worried sometimes when we look over the fence at somebody else doing something, because it's a totally different society. But we need to bring some change in, and quickly. And I think it's not that difficult to do. And the reforms we've gone through in the last few years, you'd have a lot of head teachers scratching their heads going, what's all this one about? Why are we doing this? You know, numbers and letters at the same time, and changing things, it sometimes seems for change's sake. I understand people want to raise the bar to raise the academic bar, but it just doesn't seem to make sense.
I could go on for hours about this. I think the system puts will 100% put pressure on the children. Let's start with that, which is the worst bit.
Yeah.
The system also puts pressure on parents, because we're looking at our children, they're being graded and marked. It's a reflection on us as well. We're also looking at, and as a parent, you're trying to juggle your children's welfare as well. And you're thinking, how much time do they stick to doing their work? How much time do they have for play, a leisure time? I think mine should have a lot more leisure time, a lot more relaxing time. But that's how I feel. I think that life's for living as well as for doing education. I think other parents would be shocked by me saying that.
I suppose you've got to ask, though, where does that pressure come from? Because there's such immense pressure on schools to get exam results.
Yeah.
And therefore, that's cascaded to the teachers. I think the teachers, you know, when you're talking to a teacher at a parents' evening, they're almost going, Tim, what do you want me to do about it? We're just being battered, bruised, kicked, told to do this 1 minute, told to do this, and new specifications here. It's a little bit like, how do we stop that cycle? Because
right.
it goes from the government, for example, and Ofsted into schools. Schools will put it onto the teachers and the kids. The parents are going, I want to send my kid to the school with the best grades because that's what I think education's about. At some point, we've got to stop this machine from going and go back to base one and say, what is education for? Now, we've tried to do some of that at Harrop. And as a parent, I cannot tell you what Ofsted grade. I've got three boys, one in a primary, one in a junior, one in a senior school. And I cannot tell you any of their Ofsteds because it doesn't matter to me. I want to go into those schools and see how they feel. But you're going to have to get the kind of communities at large across the UK to have that mindset. And that is the biggest wrestle.
But this, what I was going on to say is the pressure is on the children, it's on the parents. The pressure is also on every teacher put on by the governors, put on by the system, basically, all the way down. And then it's this huge, ridiculous competition that you're involved in.
Yeah.
So you've got all the schools vying against each other, like a league table, like the Premier League or something. And then, so you've got the schools vying against each other, which is ridiculous. I mean, it seemed like a good idea at the time to try and get the schools at the bottom to kick themselves up. But now you realise all they do is put the pressure back onto the children because the children, because they want the schools to succeed.
That's exactly what happens.
Yeah, exactly. So it's absolute nonsense. And then you've got the children who are now vying to become the best student rather than just, I know maths, I know English, I can speak French, I understand geography, you know, I enjoy history. It's now like, how good can I get at it? How good, and a lot of it, I'm sorry I'm moaning on here, but a lot of it is about memory. I watch my children, they're memorizing stuff. It's like, you don't need a memory anymore. You've got Google,
you've got
your memory in your
yeah.
phone and your computer is a lot better than your memory will ever be. Now, you know, I'm not... It's nice to know stuff, but for God's sake, it can't just be judged on how good your memory is at the end of the day.
But you're not judging like for like, though, don't forget, because every community is different and every community has different needs. So if you do want to be a doctor and you do want to go, then you'll need a certain education. But what about some kids who don't want to do that? They're being forced down that system, and different areas have different kids. So for example, if my son is not going to pass his maths, I'm going to sit with him,
yeah.
or I'm going to get somebody who can do this, or I'm going to buy a tutor in. Whereas in other areas, they're not going to have the time, the money, or the inclination, perhaps, because they might not see the value in education to sit and do that. So what we're actually doing is we're comparing schools that are completely different from completely different areas in completely different things. And therefore, that is not a smart thing to do, because all that you're going to do is the school will not look at its community and say, this is what this community needs. We need more vocational courses, or we need the things that, and I'm not saying that you'd have that in certain areas, because in all areas you'd need vocational courses, but that is being stripped down, and we've got a very, very narrow focus on schools. But that's an easy thing to compare. So for government, you know, statistics, that will be very easy to compare, because we're all comparing, because we're all doing the same subjects. But the ridiculous thing is there's going to be, you know, if you're coming in with certain students who are coming from certain backgrounds, we can see the stats coming through. White working class kids are not performing well. They're not performing well, and we know that. So we've got to dig into why that is, as opposed to just keep comparing people, because they're coming with different mindsets and they're coming from completely different backgrounds.
When you say mindsets, do you mean the parents aren't engaging in the school?
Some might not, some will. I mean, you can never say a working class parent is one, because that is something that frustrates me when I read that. I come across that and people go, oh, well, working class parents don't care. I'm like, excuse me, they do. A lot of them do.
At your school, did you have a few generations of, say, the children who weren't bothering, their parents hadn't really bothered, and it was a few generations?
Yeah, four generations we've had of worthlessness.
Not their fault, the fault of basically the society and schools not giving, not being able to do it.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, I'd agree. Absolutely agree. And it depends, as a parent, the value you put on education. I mean, everybody's different. I mean, even someone like yourself who's been very successful, you have a certain value you're putting on education. You think it's important, but for you it won't be the be all and end all. But somebody next door to you might have a completely different value on education. But what you've got to do is strip that back to white working class people. There's been a lot of research done on this at the moment to say they're still not achieving, and we've got to understand. I think it will all come down to the mindset that we can create within those young people to actually encourage them to achieve more than they have, and smash through some of the glass ceilings that they will perceive that are put on them. This education system, though, I'm going to say I do think it puts some people off because they're not doing courses in things that they want to do, and that's not just for the white working class. That's for everybody. I mean, you know, you can't do art and art textiles, even though fundamentally they're completely different subjects, but they've got the same exam code, so you couldn't study those. You might have the next, you know, Vivian Westwood in your school, but she won't be able to follow a lot of those subjects that she'd want to do. And there's a good chance that somebody might say, listen, Vivian, you're very bright, and therefore we want you to do those subjects. Why don't you not do art? You just go down this one because you're going to do very well in it. You're going to get great grades. You can go on to college and university in something you don't want to do, which is useless. And by the way, you're going to make the school look good in the process.
Yeah.
So that's what's happening in schools, and they're being forced to do things they don't want to do.
Yeah. You've got to read Will Storr's book, actually, because he talks about how everything becomes a competition. I like the fact you're writing it down. Will Storr, selfie. It is a great book because it talks about how society became everything, every job, everything became a competition. We've now done it with our children, and I think that's really bad. My belief on school is if you're having a horrific time at home, school should be the one place you come to and realize that there's people there who care about you, which is what you and your brothers have done. And the rest of the staff, because as you say, you haven't excluded any children, so it doesn't matter what they're doing. You're going, we care about you.
Yeah.
We're not rejecting you. I think doing Sunday brunch, I've mentioned this to you before as well, that the amount of people we have on the show, and we say, how did you make it? And they go, well, a teacher believed in me. And sometimes it's hard for parents to believe in their children because they're busy or they're tired or they've been working or they're stressed. A teacher can take time out to give that child that little bit of care and that little bit of confidence, and I think teachers are very important.
Yeah, I mean, you're always with your parents, aren't you? So even though they have a huge impact on you, they might not kind of say something that's that overly profound thing that sticks with you forever. You'll have their little sayings, but because you live with them, you almost get a bit desensitized.
Yes.
So who are the other significant others that the young person will come across in their life that could spark an interest, that could get them excited about a particular career prospect or get them just to believe in themselves? And that's my own personal story. I wasn't good at school, but there was one teacher very early on and then a couple at secondary school that really believed in me. And when that happens, you know, we know a lot about psychology, don't we? And I read something a few weeks ago now, is this idea of putting a 10 on somebody's head. And I was listening to this thing. That's really interesting. A 10. So what they were saying was, you think of somebody in your life now that just thinks you're amazing. They just think you're brilliant. And that might be a relative. It might be a parent. For me, it would probably be one of my parents who think, you know, they don't just think I run Harrop Fold. They think I'm running the damn country. They're like, they've got this idea of me that is amazing. And when they think that, you know, that person thinks that of you. How do you operate when you're around them? How do you behave when you're around that person that thinks you're just a 10 out of 10? And when I heard this, I thought, my goodness me, that is powerful. Because how do I operate when one of my parents thinks that I'm up there? I'm together. I've got the answers. You know, I'm very like clear in my thought processes. When you do that for a young person, if you say to a young person, I think you are absolutely amazing. What will that young person behave like? What will they do? And that is probably my biggest tip on behavior management to anyone. No one cares what you know until they know that you care, the very famous quote. And actually putting a 10 on someone's head is significant. And if you ever hear somebody says, this teacher changed my life for whatever reason, Jason Manford talked about it, didn't he, on Sunday brunch, when he could have gone one of a couple of ways and he could have been the class clown, but a teacher got him to write something out and then got him to rewrite it out. And that was when he fell in love with his, you know, view of storytelling and telling amusing stories. And it's always because that teacher put a 10 on your head. And I think you can break it down even more than it was a teacher. I think it's a teacher really believed in me, or a teacher put that 10 on my head. And when that happens to somebody, they start to operate, they behave differently, and that's all down to the belief mechanism. And you've not always got to believe in yourself. I learned this through sport as well. You've not, and through working in schools, you've not always got to believe in yourself, but you've got to have somebody that believes in you. So there's a quote that came across in the show, and obviously I use this an awful lot with the kids. If you don't believe in yourself, borrow someone else's belief. Because there's enough people around you that believe in you, you can go on to do it, even if you've got those doubts yourself. Because we all have that little voice, don't we, in the back of our heads that says, not quite sure you're made up for, not quite sure you're cracked up for, it's not quite sure you can get there. But surround yourself with people who believe in you, then you will start to behave differently. And that's what I think we've done at Harrop.
Yeah, can I just say at this point that I think the schools in our country are brilliant. I don't think they're terrible. I think it just needs a change. It needs to just, I think we're putting too much pressure on the schools, too much pressure on the children. I think it just needs a tiny shift. The just to sort of explain myself, because I feel like I've been quite down on our schools, and I don't want to put more pressure on our schools and teachers. I just think we need to take the competition away. We need to stop saying you're in a huge competition. Just say we need professional people. We need like people like you to come into the profession and say, I want to look after the children. I know you've been offered jobs out of your school, haven't you, to move away, and you're going, no, I want to look after these children. That's true, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it is. And I don't think you've been down on the schools. I think you're questioning the school system and the impact the school system's having on young people in schools. That is a really important question.
I want them to skip into school whatever age they are. I want them to go to school and say, hey, today I was trying to solve climate change.
Yeah.
I want them to go, no, I was doing another boring lesson where I was trying to memorize something. It's like, today what we did was we discussed this. When my kids come home and they talk, they do RE lessons and stuff, and when they discuss that, they love it because it's a lot of philosophy involved in it, and it's expanding their minds. And then you can tell there's other lessons where they're just going through the motions always, and it's like, but I always say to them, you know, where's the lesson on happiness?
Yeah.
And where's the lesson on love? And I always say to them, well, I've said this to you before, where's the lesson on rejection? Because that happens to everyone, not only in relationships, but in work.
Yeah,
Life is full of rejection.
Absolutely.
It happens on a weekly basis in my life. it happens regularly to people all the time. Where's that lesson to go, hey, it's fine to be rejected? Do you know, we've discussed this before. There should be some sort of lessons, shouldn't there, with children? And
again, it'll be finding curriculum time, but we've got to make time because it's so crucial. Someone once asked me my educational philosophy, and I've said, look, you know, I can kind of go into loads of detail, but I'm a simple person. So here is my educational philosophy. Get them in, get them smiling, get them learning. That's it. And I think that you do it in that order. They'll come in because you're going to make them smile, you're going to make them happy, you're going to get them learning. That's for the staff too, by the way. And I think that too many schools are so focused on everything that happens with the kids, they forget that actually the real difference makers in the culture of everything can be the teachers, and they can make a really boring lesson incredibly interesting. So I'm quite keen on that. You know, from our conversation previously, I love positive psychology. I think it is so powerful. When people say, how's this school survived? Because it doesn't make sense on paper. We still don't make financial sense on paper as we're trying to convert to academy status. People are telling us, but you don't make financial sense. And I'm like, I know, but we're still here. And they've been saying that for 8 years, and we'll be here in another 8 years because we'll make it work. And it doesn't make sense to work at Harrop, but we've made it work. And we've done that through utilizing the power of positive psychology. And that's about understanding that you can get so much out of people if you can create a happy place to work. And I don't mean the glib happiness. I mean scientific happiness. I mean the understanding of how people actually tick. And if you look at the research on this without, you know, wanting to give you war and peace on it, every bit of research says pretty much the same thing. If you can create a positive and a happy environment, and positive and happy people within that environment, they will be more productive, they will be more creative, and they will be more resilient.
What about teachers? How is it at the moment? How are they feeling? Do they feel happy in their place of work? That I know they do at your school. You're making them feel that way, but generally, on a whole, is the profession happy?
Well, if you look at the stats of 450,000 teachers in our state school system and 35,000 people left in 2016, that's 8.1% left this amazing profession last year, and that is not people retiring. So you're looking at it and saying, no, it isn't great. There's a lot of reasons for that. People say workload. I think that's part of it. People say money. I think that's part of it. There's been a capped pay for teachers. I think the biggest reason is people are moving away from a curriculum that they believe in. I think they're looking at the curriculum and saying, I don't even believe this is the right way to prepare kids. And all of those three things, I think, are getting people to question, why would I want to teach? Because I want to teach to change people's lives, and I don't think I'm going to be able to do that because I've got so much work. There's workload on marking because of the expectations are crazy. Money's not great, and I don't even believe in the way that we're delivering education anyway. And because of that, I think that's why people are moving away from teaching. And there's a lot of negativity about teaching. But I would also say that there's a lot of positivity in teaching as well. But like negativity, is, you know, all around us all day. We live in a negative world. Pick up a newspaper, there's not going to be that many positive news stories in it. It's the way life is. So you're going to hear the negatives more. And I heard a great stat the other day that when you get some negative news, you're going to tell on average 14 people. When you get some good news, you're going to tell on average 4. So we understand that this negativity is going to spiral. Yeah. So we're not going to hear about the teachers who are loving their jobs and getting excited by it. But we have got to say as well, there is a problem. If 8% of teachers left last year because of things like workload, money, not believing in the curriculum and moving away, I think it's all about moving away from the core purpose of why you come into teaching. We have got an issue. But I think that could be fixed with a few tweaks as well.
Like what?
Well, I think if we as leaders, school leaders, have got to take a big responsibility here and work on culture. This isn't just school leaders, by the way. If you look at the Gallup stats on people working, over 60% of people in Western culture feel disengaged from the work. I mean, that is an alarming statistic. And that's same in nursing, same in policing, same in corporate business. So wherever you go, people are feeling disengaged from work. And I think there's ways and means that you can get people back engaged and you can remind them about the purpose of why they came in to do this job. Because if you're constantly saying exam results, or you're a police, you know, sergeant or an inspector saying crime stats, or NHS doing stats, you're going to get fed up with it and you're going to forget the fact that you've just saved somebody's life in the NHS, or you've just managed to lock up a dangerous person in the police, or you've just changed a young person's life because they've had a terrible time at home and they've come into school and they've had some success and they've had a happy day when they're going home to a challenge at home. We forget the good stuff. And we remember the difficulties that seem to pervade our thoughts.
There was a guy in the ambulance service who recently did this hashtag called, I think it was blue light hashtag or something. Did you hear about that?
I did hear about that. Yeah.
So just to sort of say, appreciate the paramedics, the ambulance service, and people did it and they all got stuck in. I think a similar thing should be done on teaching, because I've quoted on, it's very weird actually, on Sunday Brunch, I've said it a lot. My sports teacher, Mr. Graham Brown, was the reason I went to school.
Right.
He was so passionate about sport and me. He really, that thing, he believed in me all the time. He got me playing all the sports and got me into them. And he stuck up for us all the time.
And you do anything for him in return?
I do. I never do public speaking. He phones me up and says, come to the school and do a speech. I go there immediately.
Yeah,
I do it for him because he meant so much to me.
But that is the key to it. There's a relationship.
I still speak to him now, you know that. And he's still in touch with loads of the pupils because he had such a huge impact on all our lives. He realized that when people went to school, like people like me, I wanted to do exercise as well and I wanted to do sport. And he changed stuff around so we could do it as well as much as possible. So Simon Rimmer on my show is always mentioning teachers. We all have one. I think it could be a good thing for us to do a hashtag mention my teacher. That would be a good day, because we should get teachers to remember that the kids, they make huge impact on our lives.
Yeah, I agree.
All teachers. Yeah.
I mean, they tried to do a thank a teacher day a while ago, but I don't think it really took off, which is a shame.
Just we're going to run out of time soon because we've been going for quite a long. Well, we're not going to run out of time, but we've just been going a long time. So let's just find out about you, the man, quickly before we go into our questions. Because you get up early in the morning and you...
Yes, yeah? 3 minutes to five every day.
Why 3 minutes to five?
My alarm did it one day at 1 minute past five. and I just had a good day. So I thought, well, I'll leave it at that. And then as time's gone by, you always need another couple of minutes. And because I was getting up in the fives, I thought, I'm going to try the fours, even though I just edged into it and I quite like it. So I might try for 2018, I might go for 7 minutes to five, I think, nice. is my new target. Just give myself another couple of minutes.
Oh, what do you do in the morning at that stage?
Train every day. So I've not had a day off training for over 11 years now, which you'd think if I'd been doing that every day, I'd look better than I do.
Yeah, you look
but
good.
So I do that every morning. And as well as training, I do audiobooks. And that's how I like to learn. So I make notes as well as I'm listening to audiobooks. Very sad. Me in a pair of shorts and a t-shirt in the garage every morning, learning and training.
Yeah, audiobooks about?
Leadership, success, culture, achievement, those kind of topics. I've started it when we were in special measures because I thought it'd be exciting to learn that. Really picked up the pace of learning when I became head and we were dealing with the debt because nobody could give us any answers. There were no experts. Everybody had written us off. So that's really when it picked up pace, and that learning's been crucial.
And then school, what time do you have to get there for?
Well, I leave at just before 7 and then get in for around 7:30.
So, and you also go off and do lots of speaking as well, educating. What do you do in your, because you've got your own external business, haven't you?
Yeah.
Leadership business.
All the money goes to school though. I don't take a penny of that, and the same with the book.
Oh yeah, we must mention the book because Educating Drew, it's the story of the school. It's very good.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we're really pleased with it. It's got a bit of a story about my upbringing and my experience of education, which wasn't the best. My two brothers are in it. And then it tells the Harrop story. And then there's some leadership work at the end.
And there's lots of brilliant quotes in here as well. You like your quotes, don't you?
Yeah.
Winston Churchill. We make a living by what we get. We make a life by what we give. Yes.
Teachers.
That's
teachers, isn't it, for you? And I think, yeah, so we learned a lot about leadership. Some of it's in the book. But what I was doing was I was reading about leadership and I was thinking that doesn't quite work in our environment. So we started writing our own material, our own models just for ourselves. And then after a while, people would say, oh, could you come and do a talk on that? So we went into sport, obviously, because I was working in sport. Then we went into the police and they said, Drew, this stuff's really helping us. It's really working. Then we started to be paid for it. And then we started doing some in the NHS. And then more recently, we've gone into, you know, huge, big corporate firms down in London. And it's a good money spinner. It's one of the ways we can balance our books, to be honest, because, you know, you get quite a few £1,000 for an hour's talk.
So you talk and you give all the money back to the school?
Yeah, every penny.
That's amazing.
People have suggested that. And the first person who heard about it was doing an article for The Times, a guy called Andrew Billen. And he was like, are you serious? Like every penny? And Piers Morgan picked up on it on Good Morning Britain. And to me, I don't understand why, wouldn't I? I'm well paid. I'm very fortunate to even work at the school, never mind be head. If I can give a bit more money back to the school and offset it against my salary, so probably this year, hopefully I won't cost the school anything at all. And that for me is brilliant. And I should do that because there's kids in an area that need that money.
That's, you know why you do that is because you read all these leadership books and you understand the value of money is not as important as the value of the generosity you're giving those children.
Yeah, but maybe that's entrenched in my thinking. I've not really thought about it other than I couldn't understand why on earth I wouldn't do that. This is about those kids and I can't see past Harrop Fold, as I explained to you when we've met previously. The place is amazing. So if I can tip some money back in and it's going to allow us to bring a teacher in, or, you know, if we do, I'm doing a talk tomorrow for a massive insurance company, probably the biggest insurance company in the world. And we're getting, you know, enough money to pay three teachers for a month for that 1 hour's talk. So that's brilliant. So I suppose I get pimped out on behalf of Harrop.
That's good. As well as Winston Churchill, you've got a quote here from Spider-Man. With great power comes great responsibility, says Spider-Man. So if people want to buy the book, where do they get it from?
They can get it on Amazon. All good bookshops, of course, yeah. I should say that. And they can get it direct from us as a school as well. And we take them when we do speeches, so we can get them sold as well.
It's a good read. Okay, everyone who comes on this show, we ask them the same question, so we'll ask you with them. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
It would have to be the hare and the tortoise, because hard work will always beat talent. It really gets exciting when you have talent linked with hard work. That's when people go and do something really amazing. But hard work is so crucial, and we have all these kind of sexy ideas that people lord out there, but you can't beat rolling your sleeves up and grafting.
You listen to all these audiobooks. Could you give us a couple of your favourites for our listeners?
Reimagine by Tom Peters is a great book. He's a business guru, I suppose, over in America. John Maxwell, anything by John Maxwell is brilliant. He was the guy who put the 10 on the head, and that comes from a book called Winning with People. Anything by Jim Collins. He's written 4 books, Good to Great, Great by Choice, How the Mighty Fall, Built to Last. That's probably a decent start off a 10.
That's pretty good, giving us 3 there. What mistakes do people make?
When they don't admit mistakes. I know that's a bit of a ridiculous response, but the amount of people who won't admit when they've made a mistake, and I think that's probably one of the issues we've got. Matthew Syed, another brilliant author, I was fortunate to do a speech with, wrote a brilliant book called Black Box Thinking, about how we learn from failure. And he's basically saying in the NHS, we don't learn. I know he's had a bit of stick for this, but we don't learn from failure. We make excuses. And in the airline industry, we learn from failure by opening the black box, sharing all the information and making sure that never happens again. And he said, that's the difference between the two. You've got to learn from failure. So the biggest mistake we make is not realizing that we will make mistakes, and it's part of the learning process. And if you look at anybody learning, they make a hell of a lot of mistakes on the way.
Any life hacks?
Life hacks. Definitely taking some time for yourself. I know it's really difficult to do that, but taking some time out, mindfulness. So when I finish my training, I'll do about 10 minutes just being thinking or not thinking, depending on your view on mindfulness. But actually just taking some time out to myself, and, you know, getting up early, I can do that. Even when I'm learning, I think that is some time for myself also to get my thoughts together, but then some time quietly thinking.
And what is the meaning of life, finally?
Golden rule, I'd have to say, you know, do unto others as you'd have done for you. And I think if you go out there and do that, I think you can, people talk about the benefit of random acts of kindness. I think going out there and being a decent person is, for me, making an impact. As Steve Jobs said, another quote, you know, go out and make a dent in the universe. That for me is really important. And I'd say that is close to the meaning of life, having an impact and being a decent person.
If people want to contact you, how do they get hold of you on social media?
Twitter at Drew Povey, Instagram at Drew Povey. My Twitter feed's not great unless you're really into leadership. It could be a cure for insomnia for some.
And your Instagram at Drew Povey as well?
Yeah, at Drew Povey on Instagram. And we've got a website, drewpovey.com, for the speaking, external speaking work.
Hopefully I wouldn't have infuriated too many people with my opinion on education. I'm struggling because I'm grappling around with it all. I'm not an expert on it by any stretch of the imagination. I'm just watching my children get stressed and other people's children get stressed. I think what would be the great thing to do is open up conversation about it. So if you are listening to this podcast, you think I've talked nonsense, or you think you've got some stuff to talk to Drew about, I think it'd be great if we just start opening up conversation. Go to our Twitter pages, talk to us. And do you agree with that, Drew?
I think it's a great idea.
Let's open up conversation about it.
I think it's about dialogue, because education impacts everybody. And it's also, as you said, it's a service, isn't it, that everybody receives for free in this country. And whilst you might get hate mail, I suppose some of the things I've said on here could get me sacked. But the difference is, for everybody, we've got to start looking at education and asking the question. We do it with everything else in life, don't we? You know, we get into the nitty gritty of anything we buy on Amazon. Is this the right thing? What is it we want to do? Or anything we do in life, we want to know the nuances of exactly how it works. We've got to do that with education. And as we look at exactly how it works, it'll throw up some questions that we've got to get through.
Yeah, what are we doing with our children? How are we looking after them? And as society's moving on, technology's moving on, how are we embracing that with schools and our children? Yeah. Listen, thanks so much for coming on. I really enjoyed our conversation today. And I'll come up to the school one day. I promise you I'll do
that. Please do. Yeah, you need to come for a tour.
I will do that. I'm definitely doing that. Thanks a lot, Drew.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure.
So that was Drew Povey. If you want to buy his book, it is called Educating Drew. It's worth buying because A, it's a good book. I enjoyed reading it. And B, all the money goes to his school. So it's a good cause. He's a nice guy, isn't he?
He was. Obviously focusing as a producer here, but I was half time just being like, I can't stop listening. It's so interesting.
As he left, I said, what do we do? What do we do about this? Because I think we need to engage more people. And he said, we just got to talk, dialogue. That's it. We just got to keep talking. There's nothing fundamentally wrong with our education system. It just needs reform. We need to work out why the children are there, what we're doing with them, and make sure they have the best education they possibly can. If you want to engage me, I'd love it because I've got so many ideas. I was going, what about this idea? What about that idea? I didn't really want to get draw Drew in on the podcast about them, but I've got so many ideas on what we should be doing with the education system, but I'm not sure any of mine are right. But please let me know at Tim Lovejoy or dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com if you want to send us an email. You can subscribe, and also we'd like you to rate us, give us 5 stars. Please let me know what you think of this podcast, though. Did I cross the line? Should I just stay with questions, or do you want to hear my opinions as well? Let me know. Thanks for doing this today, Fina.
Thank you.
We'll see you all very soon. Bye.
Bye.
Oh, peace and love, Joy. I nearly forgot my own catchphrase. Peace and love, Joy.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.